I never actually thought I'd paint armies. I thought my intention was to paint single miniatures for heavy metal. I got bored real quick.
What is it about big army projects for you that doesn't scare you?
I've never copied a colour scheme. That's usually why your army ends up being a bit of a car crash. When someone says to me, like, oh, what are you painting tonight? I'm like, I'm doing 40 skeletons. They'll be like, what? I'm only painting one. I'm like, oh, I'm painting 40 because it's fun.
It does feel like the kind of fundamental, like, essential tip to army painting is like,
so I just went down to the shop just to get some tea. I couldn't decide what to pick up, and I need some advice. And who else better to ask than Peachy Tips? Best man, welcome to
painting. Yorkshire tea.
Peachy Tips is pretty good, I'm not gonna lie.
That's the best variation of the guest introduction trope that you've got so far, I think.
I was brewing that one for quite some time.
Nice.
I want to say, for the record, he pitched that to me like 2 days ago. He's been like preparing. Don't think that was just like off the cuff.
Why do you want to ruin the magic?
The original one was when I think we had, it was either the looting one or the mini wargaming Dave one. And James was like, yeah, for days. He was like, yeah, and I think I'm just going to do this thing where I'm like, I was walking around outside and I just happened to see the, he was like so proud of it.
Okay, so if anyone watching, they have just killed every introduction moving forward.
Oh, we're doing them every time. We're doing them every time.
No, we have to stick to the bit now. We've established in the law. So
the law?
Yeah.
It's not 40K. Come on.
It's like the podcast law. We've got the Jamesisms. We've got our own lexicon.
Okay, all right. Welcome to Paint Perspective. On that note, how are you?
I am great. Good. I am great. Peachy, you could say.
Yeah, oh, good. Puns are flowing today. It's going to be a good one.
It's going to be one of them episodes, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's good. So we're really, really glad to have you here, obviously, to chat about our favourite thing, which is obviously miniature painting. Mm. You've got a vast swathe of experience with that across all different platforms and all different sort of mediums and stuff, which is really, really good. I just thought it'd be really interesting to get your opinion on various different things about, obviously, miniature painting. We've got a massively wide demographic of different types of painter that watch the show or listen. And yeah, it's just really good to have you with the experience you've got and obviously talk about the awesome things that you're doing now. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you say experience, definitely no talent.
I don't know about that. I think you're being very, very humble. But no, I think, yeah, you definitely, like, I remember seeing you in sort of like early GW books I think some painting books that I've got that you're in as well. It's a very young, like the young version of you. Don't take that the wrong way.
Yeah, you mean the hair version.
I don't remember the photographs that much.
Yeah, it was definitely hair.
Okay, but no, I thought it was really good to sort of get someone on that's had all different aspects of experience from working obviously for Games Workshop, for doing obviously your own thing you've been doing recently, and then just talk about the future of you, about obviously the things that you're doing moving forward as well, which I think is good. So I think for the show, like, we want to obviously talk about sort of like painting armies and other things like that, and it's often a topic which a lot of people sort of struggle with. And having someone that's worked in that environment and worked on armies and that consistency and all those kind of things, I just thought it'd be a really good thing to sort of open the floor of discussion and talk to you about.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those weird things that I never actually thought I'd paint armies. I thought my intention was to paint single miniatures for heavy metal when I was a wee little nipper looking through White Dwarf going, oh, I want to do that. They look cool. And I think it came into its being probably when I was in retail, like painting stuff for the cabinets. Really enjoyed like painting stuff for the boards, the gaming boards, the cabinets and stuff. And then a job came up to do armies.
Yeah, yeah.
The workshop, I was like, oh, that sounds fun. I'm going to do that. That sounds great. Got a job. And I had a couple of opportunities to sit with heavy metal and do some painting. And this was like, oh, this is great. I get to learn how to be an heavy metal painter. I got bored real quick. It was like, and I think it must be my like makeup. I don't know if it's something to do with me just being very impatient or just having a short attention span or something like that. But I had a couple of tasks where one was painting a Stegodon and the crew. And I was 3 days in and I was done in my head. Uh-huh. I was happy enough for the models and heavy metal were like, it could do a little bit more. I'm like, I'm done. I'm so done with this now.
I've got to admit, the scales on like a Stegodon or something like that, that is a lot of edge highlighting.
It was. I mean, that was the thing. I kind of enjoyed doing. And then like Neil Green, or Nibs as he's known in Workshop, was showing me like painting textures on skin and stuff. And that was fun. So I learned lots from there. But then like 4 days later, I'm still like, I can't see past this. I think my brain was just like, you see these heavy metal painters and like high-end painters and they do amazing things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think from my point of view, there's something out there for everybody. But mine is like, yeah, I see the craft. I appreciate the craft. It's amazing. But I personally just don't have the drive to want to get to that point, because I could have painted another 50 Empire State Troops in that time, or I could have done another, you know, Army of Uruk-hai or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So
where do you think that stems from? Is it like just you enjoy having different stuff and like moving on to the next thing?
I think I think it's having... I going back to the short attention span, maybe. Some people say, Peach, I think you've got ADHD. I was like, I don't even know what that means, but sure. I just like to move on to new things, and I think scratching lots of itches.
Yeah, yeah.
And I struggle to focus on one thing for a long period of time.
That's interesting though, because a lot of people's like nature of loving the speed is like, oh, I've got this limited time and I want to paint armies for games. But you don't hear a lot of people saying, like a lot of people who would say, oh, I've got a short attention span, they just want to jump from like single figure to single figure, not necessarily like big army projects.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting to hear.
Yeah, doing the armies, it's weird as well, because it's a lot of figures and there's a certain amount of discipline required. So when someone says to me like, oh, what are you painting tonight? I'm like, I'm doing 40 skeletons. They'll be like, what? I'm only painting one. And I'm like, oh, I'm painting 40 because it's fun. And I could play a game to them tomorrow or whatever. So it was definitely something that I really enjoyed doing. I don't do as much nowadays. I find that my attention span and like scratching those itches come from doing like a warband or a kill team or a Necromunda gang. I don't think I can be bothered to do an army anymore. I think lockdown killed that. And the only reason is I painted three armies during lockdown, never got to play a single game with them.
I mean, that'll do it.
And I was like, I'm just going to do some small squads instead. So I got more done.
No, totally. I think it's really interesting as well. I think there's direct correlation for like execution between painting someone who paints a model really high end and invests hours and hours and hours into it, and then someone who invests almost the same applicable amount of time into producing an army that for whatever standard it's painted to, it's the presentation of the army and just having that large swathe of force or something to actually have function with afterwards. I think they're very similar. Like the drive to achieve those results, I believe, is very, very similar. It's just the type of execution or the way it's approached is the thing that actually differs. Yeah. And that's really the interesting thing. Like you've got people like yourself, obviously, that got a lot of army experience. You've obviously done, in the early days, you've done stuff that's obviously higher end, definitely. That's one of the things I think that I definitely wanted to speak about with yourself, obviously, coming on, is that I know that you're known for painting, obviously, and being in the army painting team and managing that team in the past, etc. But you still can paint to a very, very decent standard. And I think you don't, from what I've seen on conversations, I think that's not maybe conveyed as much as I'd like to talk about. Because I think I've seen stuff you painted and it is very, very good. So I think that talking about armies in that nature and being able to do both sides of the coin, so to speak, just gives you a good skill set to approach whatever project you tackle, which is quite good. But yeah.
Yeah. It's a few people have asked me about that, saying that, you know, you paint quite to a high, I've seen you paint to a high standard before, but you don't do that much nowadays. And I think a lot of that stems from being in the Warhammer TV team, doing lots of tuition videos, and then having, so like take Duncan, for instance, he paints really nicely and has like a set of standards he follows, which is like base coat, layer, shade, highlight. I try and find shortcuts to get things on the tabletop, but still look quite cool from a distance, because I always play at arm's length when I'm painting. I'm always like arm's length kind of like level. So it looks fine to me from there, because that's the distance I'll be playing games at. And through doing all those videos, I was always like looking for hacks or shortcuts to get things looking cool, but, you know, usable on the tabletop, knowing I can paint better. But I think it's that working in retail, doing those paint sessions, doing those videos to try and help people, realizing that there's a lot of paint guides out there that focus on very high end techniques, which is really good, because once you get to a certain point, you can do that. So an example is like you see DIY videos on YouTube showing you how to, I don't know, refit glass in a window or how to refit a door. I'm like, but what happens if people don't know how to do certain things, like using a screw or, you know, screwdriver very well, or
like the basic things?
There's all those things that you've assumed knowledge before you've even got to like the fitting of the door, you know, sizing it up, getting the right kind of materials, or, you know, where do you go for these kind of things and stuff like that. So I was always of the mind that there's a lot of guides that teach you some really cool next step skills, and they're not really good, but there's very few that teach those fundamentals, those basics.
Do you think content has kind of in general online kind of created that sort of one-upping effect? Where
I think so, yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think it's really, really cool to see all the different things people do, but I do feel it's had an impact on people's perceptions on painting. They see all this stuff and think, oh, that's really good. I wish I could paint like that. And a lot of people watch them because they want to paint like that, but they inevitably struggle to get to that point. Whereas in my head, I'm like, there's such a big gap of like, I don't even know the numbers, but I'm going to like be generous and say 80% of our customer base probably can't paint to that standard, don't have the time. And this is the thing I think I do feel is forgotten. There's a lot of people that paint really well, but they have 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
Or for like 5 days a week, like, you know, taking Duncan or Louise, that's their job now. They do it all day, every day. Rich Gray, you know, that's one of his, you know, focus points is like, you know, sitting there doing high-end stuff and whatever. But a lot of folks out there are at school, college, uni, parents, you know, it's kind of, you get an hour if you're lucky in an evening. Yeah. And that's where my mindset is for the painting. Yeah. I was like, what, if you had a new box set and you only had 2 hours this week,
what could you get done?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that balance of like inspiring people and showing what's possible, but also making it accessible on the other end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I guess once they've used me, they can then go off and watch all those other videos and learn to paint even better. So it's like, I'm just like the bottom rung of a ladder and there's many rungs to climb.
I think totally. I think the other thing as well is like with the type of audience that kind of attracts as well, it really gives a very broad area for you to work within as well. So you get lots of people that will look to you as the first point of really how to achieve stuff that they're happy with on the tabletop. And that's always a memorable thing as well. So like, I remember like from back in the day, places I started learning from, etc. And you'd always remember that through your painting journey, so to speak. So it's quite good that you're starting at that level and helping people to progress in that way from the beginning as well.
I think when you're there at the beginning as well, people hold it a lot more like with some sentimental value when they look back. Yeah. So it's like, I thinking of getting back into it, I started painting again after I had a break about 2017 or something. So I have like fond memories of watching Duncan on Warhammer TV teaching me how to paint again.
Well, similarly, I started painting, being younger, I started painting around like 2018, and that was like off of back of your content as well.
So oh, right. Oh, yeah. Gosh. Yeah. I feel so old.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think for me, I don't know, when were you... Should we just, sorry to like take it back a few steps, but I think because a lot of this relates to what your career trajectory was within GW as well. And also we've got a lot of people who probably got into painting after you left, so might not even recognize you from that side of it. Should we just go through a quick like brief timeline of your painting career?
Yeah.
Brief. I know it's
so fast. I guess
I know it's fast. I don't want it to be the whole podcast. But just for anyone
as a lad,
to add some context.
I did a lot of painting in my own time when I was like school, college, uni, and then I got a job at Workshop, which was 2000-2001, just before Lord of the Rings kind of hit the screens. And I was in retail for about 7-8 years, then moved to the design studio at the time, not the books and box game studios it is now. And I guess that was like, what, 15 years, 12 years, give or take. And then moved into Warhammer TV after that and then left 2021.
Yeah.
So 21 years.
There's a lot of long time in with that experience. And I just thought it was important because it obviously, even so far in this discussion, like so much of your experience with these different, you know, painting armies or whatever, it just relates to what you were doing for work at that time, I suppose.
Yeah, I learned a lot in the very first 2 weeks I joined the studio. I thought I was all right at painting because I used to do stuff for the cabinets, and you're in a very insular group of like mates and stuff in one store. And then within like a week, I'm like, oh my God, these people are so talented. And my skill just went up because I was sat in a chair for 8 hours a day painting toy soldiers, and you know your skill set's going to rapidly improve, especially when you've got people around you who just like looking at you going, know what you could do? I'm like, oh yeah, use some sponge. I'm like, what? What's this? Sponge?
That's where that echo to the light comes.
That's what I've spoken about so much, is that's what I have here with these two. It's like, you know, I'm on the office side of things, but every week I have to sit down and have a conversation with these two for 2 hours about painting. And I'm like, next time I go to sit down and paint, I'm like, okay, well, I can't do that shortcut because I know I've got like George in this ear while I'm painting, so don't do that.
And we've tripped ourselves up as well with stuff we've said on the show. and like kind of have these realizations, like while we're having these conversations about things that I think I should probably be doing myself. And then when I go to make that same mistake or like crutch again, I'm like, can almost hear James or like myself speaking on
the episode. Like normally it's like things like I spoke quite early on about how I didn't like sub assemblies. And I didn't realize that everyone who decided to listen to that would then pull me up every time I post a picture of a sub-assembly. Like, I'm not allowed to do sub-assemblies anymore. I get like loads of messages every time I post one. Where it's like, oh, I thought you didn't like sub-assemblies. It's like, well, okay, I said it once. Like,
I mean, because I would probably sympathize with you on that one, because sub-assemblies, I find the only time I do it is when it's really necessary. Like, it's like cavalry and a rider and the two separate things. I can spray one color, spray them in another.
Which I did caveat when I said, just for everyone, just as an update for everyone, I did say when I said I didn't like sub-assemblies, we then did say like, yeah, sometimes it's understandable or you need to, or it's shielding certain details and things like that.
I'm going to confess something now. Normally when I was in the army painting team, I used to really like get on the backs of the staff going, drill your barrels, drill your barrels. And I got pulled up on it once for one of my videos on the painting phase. And so I was like, oh, you're not drilled your barrels? I'm not going to drill them ever again. Just to annoy you.
Yeah, that's a great way of getting it back. But yeah, that's brilliant.
I do try and drill my barrels, but the problem I have is that I'm rubbish at it. So I always drill it, ruin the barrel and go, I shouldn't have drilled it.
Just like the off-center
black
kind of
paint
thing.
Black paint dot would have been fine.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Peachy, but James uses a massive like DeWalt drill with like a 1mm drill bit on it.
He just tears swears by that.
Yeah. They call me the DeWalt sniper.
unreal.
I'm like, sat there with like my little tiny pin vise trying to be really precise. Like,
I'm going to use a term I used on a previous episode, which was I will out drill you fact.
there's a heated argument about that on the previous
episode. Well, to quote yourself, James, in one of your previous Jamesisms, that is like trying to kill an ant with a nuke.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, what's your ratio for getting it center?
Well, see, what you do is, with a pin vise, you have to do the notch in the center of the barrel.
Yeah,
anyway,
of course.
It's all about time and efficiency for me. Like, especially when it comes to the topic we've got at hand, which is army painting.
Dead serious talking about using a full-on drill drill his
I have converted many people to the power of electricity. So like all I would say is that you get the knife and make the notch perfectly center.
Yeah.
The tip, we're going to do an early episode hobby hack here. If you go do the side, as in the muzzle brake first, when you drill, put the drill bit, the drill bit on the notch, it'll go straight through. And as soon as it hits the hole that the muzzle brake hole has done, it'll guide it through center, if that makes sense.
I see,
So it works every time.
Yeah, but this is just the extra part of where you're using a power tool and
he's skipping the bit where if you mess it up, you've got a 9,000 RPM hot bit of metal that just tears through the bolt.
What are you drilling for? Blimmin' oil. All I would say is that like the trigger control on a power tool is exactly the same as like your pressure management with a brush and all those kind of things. You get used to the trigger has got
it actually does. You're sat there.
You can
it's
sit
like
there.
A momentary
this is
switch.
This
it's
is
all
not,
or nothing. It's all
I'm
or nothing.
Sorry
there's no finesse.
I'm not dropping this early because there's a certain topic that's going to get very heated later on involving colours. So let's not. But this is not the new version of that. All I would say is that if you just get used to the trigger on an electric drill, you'll find that you can drill stuff a lot quicker. You're not sitting there getting RSI in your hand, drilling all the barrels out all the time.
RSI? Nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
We'll see what I have to part with every week. This is just while we're recording.
Years later, you've got a broken hand or something, you know. So, it is what it is. But yeah, I use a, and it isn't a DeWalt. I use a really, really old.
More of a Milwaukee man.
actually, I like a Bosch. Thank you very much. You know, I use an old Bosch drill that's been like I've had for years, and you won't drill screws in the wall or anything with it. So it's quite old, and the batteries they don't last as long, and et cetera. But it's perfect for drilling barrels, and you can just get through them really quickly.
So if you listen at home, all you need is a really, really old drill that's no good anymore.
Just get a budget one that's not has got more power than the National Grid. Like, you know, it's as simple as that. Like, but no, I personally use it and recommend it because it means you can just get through stuff efficiently. And once you've got the trigger control on the drill, it's just about getting the notch perfect. Drill the muzzle brake because that's a hole to guide you. You can literally just do that straight away.
Or you can make the step that Peachy just told us all about and just decide to never drill it again.
It's not a problem. whatever you want to do.
100% success rate.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But I suppose if you've got like 100 Space Marine barrels to drill through,
when you've got a lot to
you've
do,
you've got the hand-eye coordination and the skill set going on. Then,
yeah. It, honestly, yeah. I will caveat that if you're watching this and you give it a go first time, if you do ruin your barrels, it's not my fault.
Use a test model. Yeah, use a test model
first.
No one's ever had to give that caveat when recommended a pin buy. So
yeah.
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 Anyway, painting.
Yeah.
painting.
Yeah. So so obviously, the Atomic Games Workshops gave you a real good insight into like vast projects like army painting and being consistent and all that kind of thing. So like, what have you found like for your own hobby through working in that environment and being sort of like through, I think in terms of osmosis, being in that environment all the time and obviously being surrounded by it, what are some like things that like you picked up straight away from being in that environment that not only helped you with your personal hobby, but then also helped you with your work as you were working there?
I mean, there's a lot of things. Certainly, when I was hired to do the army painting stuff, I was always the back ranker guy. So there was a lot of standards that you could drop. Mm-hmm. So from an army painting point of view, if you want to do like a 2,000 point army in a short space of time, you can find those shortcuts of what to highlight and what not to highlight. So if I was doing like a Space Marine and I've got belts on it and pouches, I'm probably going to paint them black. Maybe pick out the odd little bit of a highlight or dry brush over it, or paint it really dark gray and wash it. Mm-hmm. And then that's everything highlighted. And that was the same for a lot of things, that if you could find a shortcut or a way of trimming down the time and put your efforts into things that people will see. And one of the things, you know, you guys probably know anyway, is like, you know, the face. Most people look at the face of a model before they look at anything else. So yeah. That's where your efforts go. It's usually this part of the head and the shoulders, and everything else you can be a little bit more loosey-goosey about. And colour. I think colour was important. So punching out those colours, getting like your spot colours right, and just having it looking nice and bright from a distance. But certainly when I started, you'd have like heavy metal do the first five. So if we take Warhammer Fantasy Battle, you have like 20 Skaven in a unit. I always use Skaven as a random example. So you have like five at the front which were painted by heavy metal. I'll do then the next 15 that went behind it, but the first group of 15 would have to be a little bit better because they're the second rank in that you'd see, and then the ones after that can really cut corners.
It's almost like a fade through the unit. Yeah, that's really interesting.
In a weird way, from my point of view, I'd want to paint them all the same standard, but it made sense from a photography point of view that you had different gradients of level.
It never occurred to me that was how you guys did that over there.
And certainly we did. And then eventually it was heavy metal did all the box cover stuff themselves because the team just grew and grew. Because I think when I joined, it was like, it was only seven, but still, you know, they had a big workload. But now they're on like 12, 13 staff now. So they're just like pounding through all sorts of things. But I also think that their level has increased so much that they've made a rod for their own back that things take even longer. A great example was like Daz Laverm. He did a load of color variants for Chaos when the Chaos Warrior book came out when I started. And he did like a bunch of color variants for the night. And that was like a day, 2 days. And you look at the color variant, it's just like, that's amazing. That was 2 days. Skip forward 10 years. They're doing a Varangard night, which is black with gold trim, 15 days for the one figure. And I'm like, I bet Daz could do that in a day.
Just a quick one. We wanted to remind you that you can get your own miniatures painted by the world-class team here at Seed Studios. We offer a variety of painting levels and services to meet your needs and budget. Whether you want a centerpiece character or an entire gaming army, we offer well above the industry standard of quality and experience. You can learn more about our services and get a quote now at seedstudios.co.uk. And just for you podcast listeners, you can get 5% off of your first commission with us by using code PAINT5. Now back to the show.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like that jump in time allowance is massive, right? I think the interesting thing, and just segueing slightly into obviously just general painting, like painting in general over the years. I mean, we were talking about this on the previous episode, like painting the quality just from someone starting out, like some people's first models are like insane. Like,
I benefited from like, because I started like properly in like 2018. And by that point, there's like a backlog of like almost 10 years worth of YouTube videos to watch.
Yeah.
At all sort of varying skill levels. So, and kind of like you said as well, like starting out with some more basic fundamentals, and then you can kind of work your way up from there. It's a completely different playing field than it is now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
than it was back in the day.
So, yeah. You had undercoat, a couple of base coats, a wash, then heavy metal.
That was literally, it was like 1, 2, 3 heavy metal. And we always used to joke about that. But it was true. It was like, how do I get from that to that?
It's like hop, skip and a jump, top of Everest.
Yeah, it's like,
there's that meme of like an owl where it's like,
I'm so glad you brought that up. I know the person who drew that. I know the person who
did that.
Yeah, I know the person who did that. Yeah. Shout out, Stephen.
Hi, Steve. Yeah.
Shout out, Steve. Yeah, that's the first thing I just thought of. It's like, paint the rest of the owl. Yeah. Yeah, I know the person who did that. Yeah.
Anyway, that's a flex. That's a flex.
No, it's definitely moved on, has it, from when we were youth?
Like, things now, I feel like I'll kind of get into a point of like one-upsmanship. And like, I guess we're in part guilty of that because we do paint a lot of higher end stuff, but especially from the sense of like the content space, I think that there is kind of this shift now, kind of going back to the fundamentals a little bit.
So, I mean, yeah, absolutely. But I think with Siege, it's perfect because a lot of people like myself would love to paint to that standard, but faster, but still get to that standard. Mm. So like spend like a couple of hours a night and then get to the standard that you guys do. Everyone would love that because time's our most precious resource, right?
Sure.
You're going to get it back. Yeah. But if you've got the money and, or you've got the, you know, the means to like get someone else to paint it for you, mm-hmm. you can get the standard that you want or you've always wanted because there's people like you that can supply that service, mm-hmm. which I think is a really, really good thing. It means you don't have to then go, oh, you know, do I cut corners here? Do I cut corners there? No, I can make a really beautiful piece that looks amazing because someone's paying for that and that's what they want. And then they get that. They don't have to spend the evening doing it because, you know, they've saved up cash to do it. And I think it's a great thing. Whereas like someone myself, when I was a kid, I was like, how do I paint like that? I'll just keep painting models until I get better. And, you know, over the years, you find ways. And I certainly think like young Chris Peach, when he was like 13, would spray everything white and then just base coat everything badly. And then
blackline everything.
Exactly. Yeah. And then like skip like 20 years later, just like what's the closest undercoat color I can get to the majority of that model? Right. Yep. Okay. So most of it's going to be like white. All right. I'll spray it white. Or most of it's going to be red. I'll spray it red and I'll pick out all the colors. So I'm always like finding like ways to 43, nearly dead. So,
I mean, slightly more, but yeah. Okay.
Well, to be fair, using James's math.
But no, I mean, that's really cool the way, obviously, like, you know, with regards to sort of like finding the process and finding a way of doing it. I actually say this all the time when it comes to socials. So we talk about it quite a lot on these episodes. And the thing is like, one of the things that I call it is like, almost like, I'm going to say Instagram, but it's like being Instagram drunk. Like you go on there and you're bombarded by all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just like trying to, you are quite right in what you said, George, it's just like trying to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Yeah. See what I mean? And it's like, Liam made a really good point on the last episode. Like he was like, I'm just not going to look on Instagram. He's got one that uses for his personal life or whatever, blah, blah, but he just turned off and just didn't start looking at anything hobby orientated. Mm. And that kind of relit the fire in him. He's like, oh, actually, you know what? I enjoy that model. And I think as a real baseline thing, like painting something, looking at it going, okay, what am I not happy with? What am I happy with? And then trying to do another one and progressing from that to the model to the next model, that gives you more of a reward than going on there and going, and I'm going to say it again, I think it's becoming like a point scoring thing on episodes, but it's that Homer Simpson barbecue moment of like, why doesn't mine look like that? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that's the thing that I think the social media, as good as it is for painting, I think it also nowadays with how much it bombards us both on YouTube, on Instagram, on Pinterest, on Google Images, like on everything, it's our industry's grown so much since 10, 15 years ago or whatever. And the internet has almost like exploded the level quality. Like I remember going to GD like in 96 and like 97 when my family took me because I wanted to go. And then like, as I was going, when I was a bit older with friends, I used to get the bus from the store, like the buses used to go, like you used to have your flag and all that stuff for the store.
Of course, yeah.
Used to go, you know,
store banner.
Store banner, yeah, yeah. And then to see like GD, the quality at Golden Demon as an example is like a, because I see that as like kind of like a metric of painters in the community. Yeah, if that makes sense. Yeah. Like you go there and you see all manner of different paint jobs and people painting to the best that they can do for the competition. But back in the day, the quality was amazing at the time, obviously. But where it is now is insane. Like it's just like you look at some stuff that's being done, like the likes of Rich Gray, or otherwise known as the Wizard, or you know.
Wizard, yeah.
But like, you know, it's just crazy. So I think your approach and doing stuff and starting flipping it almost the other way and going, well, look, you, there's loads of that stuff out there, but I'm going to focus on the thing which is the core of what builds to that in the future. I think that's a really good way of approaching it. And I think that there's a lot of things that people, no matter how good you get as a painter, that the core competencies and the basic things which build everything else is built upon, they are one of the most important things. If you don't base coat the model properly, like, you have problems later on, if that makes sense. If you don't, like, so if you don't undercoat, prime it, whatever, blah, blah, it causes problems later on, et cetera. So like, it's a really good approach that you've almost like found the market gap by moving away from what everyone is subjugated to essentially all day long.
I think you've kind of, I think it's discredited as well as being like beginner focused, just because it's simpler or a bit more like fundamental. But I think even for myself, like, something I'm trying to make a conscious effort to do more lately is, being someone who grew up in this like Instagram generation of like everything's got to be amazing, I really struggle when painting my own stuff to not paint it to a ridiculous degree, which obviously means that it doesn't get done.
Yeah.
So I tried to start an army. I'm like, I'm going to have my own army. But I spent so long painting the models, I got like 5 done in a year.
Yeah.
And it wasn't feasible.
Yeah.
But
that's not an exaggeration.
It's a real metric. It's evidence online. But like, within that, like, find having access to like tutorials and stuff like that as well. If you're just going to like start an army, like, just because you're, once you've like accomplished that and you're comfortable in it, I don't think you have to necessarily move on and necessarily have to get better just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people just enjoy painting to that level because it's a lot less pressure and, you know, it's more accessible and there's, it's easier to get things done and you're going to see results quicker as well. Where do you see like your content going forward of your own channel, like in that regard?
So, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about that. I mean, I get a lot of comments saying it's been tier level, which is fine because it's not designed for the person that says that, which is, you know, it's fine. I've always experienced that over the years anyway. And I look at some of my content and like the Space Marine one I did recently, which was like some fundamentals of painting in general, but I use Space Marines as a canvas. Like, because the cameras are so good, they zoom in quite close so you can see all the flaws, but I'm happy to show all the flaws because that's part of, for me, the painting process. When I'm painting, certainly from an army point of view, that I make a lot of mistakes early on, but I tidy them up later on. Mm-hmm. And any mistakes I make, I tend to not be so bothered about it and just like, made a mistake. The white on his eye was a bit too much. I'll just tie that later up. Mm-hmm. But I like to show those mistakes because I think it reinforces that everyone can make mistakes, but in the stores you'd see like kids like get really upset or het up because they've got like a bit of black from the gun on the hand. They're like, oh no. I'm like, dude, it's fine, it's paint. You can literally paint over that black, it's fine. And once you start showing that kind of like cool, not stressed kind of thing, it I think it helps other people seeing that and they kind of like riff off that as well, going, oh, he's just made a load of mistakes and didn't seem bothered by it. Oh, because normally if I made that mistake, I'd dip it in like a load of like gunk to get rid of the paint.
Yeah.
And start from scratch, because I think everyone thinks that it has to be a perfect line from the off, because a lot of the videos nowadays when you see them have been edited that way because they don't want to show the mistakes because it does look awful. But I think showing that awful side of it, the ugly stage, is quite fine. And I look back at some of the videos I've done, I'm like, yeah, you know what, those eyes were a bit messy, I could have probably been a bit neat with it. But with the content going forwards, I definitely want to do more next step kind of stuff. Because I kind of did that when I was with Pat, when we were doing like the like guides. They'll be like, here's tabletop, and then here's a few things to take to the next step. And a lot of people said, oh, we'd like to see like your painting at the higher end kind of stuff. I'm like, well, I suppose there's an education in that as well, that, you know, where do you go from this basic level or intermediate level? What's the next steps to get up to those places where you can become like a Duncan or a Richard Gray or whatever?
So, I think that shows a great sense of like responsibility as well. And like taking ego out of it, I think, is really important, because I think a lot of people are afraid to show those mistakes or like the messy stage of a model because of their own, like their own skin in the game, I guess, because people don't really want others to see them in that way. Cause it's like, almost if you're the one making the content, you're like, well, I know I'm capable of not making those mistakes. So I don't want other people to think that that's where I'm at. But I think it's really important for you to show those mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people have got a lot from that, from the comments going, oh my God, it's because they make those mistakes and don't know how to fix them.
And they're like guaranteed if you're a beginner, especially you are going to make mistakes. So it's unfair to show someone something that like is not a realistic reflection on what they should be doing.
Do you know one of the things that's really, really interesting and nods directly to what you're saying? When we do classes, and when I do physical painting classes, or whether we do online or whatever, blah, blah, one of the things that often comes up is when I watch it, people say to me, when I watch a YouTube video, you don't see that part, or you don't see that that's been done, or you don't see that blah, blah, blah. You don't see those things. So one of the real virtues of what you're doing, what you're doing, is that you're showing, as you put it, like the ugly side and all those parts, how to fix them. So you're kind of filling the gap of like, there's YouTube stuff out there that you see the progress of a miniature. You see the lovely finished model and a rotation at the end, and maybe the hook picture of it at the beginning, whatever. And you see the selective parts to get you from the front bit through to the end and see it again. Hmm. On classes, people go, oh, well, you can't stop a YouTube video and ask that part or see that part, or maybe that bit hasn't been shown. Or they go, I just apply the black to all the model and you put that bit on. And then all the black's suddenly on, but you don't see the cleanup that's been done because the person slipped here or done this. I mean, you see a pristine blocked in black model, or like all the pouches are done in brown or whatever, blah, blah. So I think that approach is really, really good. And I think it, you're quite right. It gets rid of that fear of making a mistake, because it's almost like the way socials are now, you put stuff up and it's like keeping up with the Joneses. Mm. It's like, oh, did you see they've got new blinds, or we need to get new blinds. Yeah. Or like, oh, did you see they've just painted that model and they've done NMM on all the trim and all the things. Oh, I've got to do some NMM now because I've got to get that online and show that I can do that as well.
Yeah. You also kind of see that with like the techniques. Like there was a brief window. I think it's not as bad as it, I don't think it's as bad now as it has been in the past, but there was just kind of this like phase where like all the YouTubers were trying to come up with this new like gimmick of the week of like, this method is how you paint the best in the least amount of time. No, this method is how you paint the best in the least
amount of time. I've been called out on that a few times because I can't remember what I said. It was a while back and I came up with a statement. Reverse highlighting, that was it. I'd sprayed a Sentinel Silver, washed it, and then I just filled in all the areas, but didn't go to the edges, so it looked chipped and battered.
I saw that. I thought that was genius.
That's what I learned from workshop, just to get like real quick ways of like getting armored, like for orcs and stuff like that. You spray it all silver, you wash it, you dry brush it, then you fill in the color, but don't go to the edges. And it was just like Jonesy used to call it reverse highlight. I was like, I like that. And then someone's like, I hope you're not starting a new
trend
or trend like slap chop. I'm like, no, it's just. I'm not highlighting, I'm doing the reverse of that. Yeah. So I'll call it reverse highlighting. I don't know what else I would say.
Just to clarify my stance on that, I don't think it's a bad thing that people are trying to innovate or like come up with new ideas.
But you're right.
Those exercises are worthwhile, because for all you know, you could have done that and it would have turned out amazing, or it didn't work. And the only way you know that is by experimentation. So I think experimentation is important, but I don't like the idea of trying to sell people a bit of a lie, which is why I like the idea of like showing the mistakes and things like that.
Yeah, you're right. There was a trend of like, certainly after on the back of the slap shop, everyone was like trying to do different things and stuff. And I think that's why the community were like, oh, I hope you're not trying a new one. Because I think people got bored of it. It was just like, it was just too much.
Yeah. But really, it's that whole technique, again, there's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. And I just want to caveat that before I get loads of fire in the comments. But like, I think the thing is like, that has always been around. It's just, it's got a new name applied to it. And truth be told, Rob's video was great. Like his approach, the sort of like real sort of like a funny kind of way of approaching it, all that kind of stuff was brilliant. But it's all it for me is what that video done and that technique coming to the forefront again, is it just, I think it was actually really helpful because it made a lot of people go, oh, actually I can just do that and I still get decent models, you know? So the delivery of the new fad or whatever you want to call it is all well and good. But it's the fact that something comes to the forefront and people go, oh, actually, I can actually apply that and get half decent results, which is the thing.
I feel like also the slap chop thing has kind of withstood enough time to not be a fad anymore.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I don't think we can call that a fad now.
No.
People are still talking about it.
It's just given
it,
a name.
Still doing it.
I do think that was the spawn of that kind of thing. I think people were trying to chase
people,
the next
people
slap
like,
chop.
Oh, I want to come up with my one of them.
But
the actual slap chop.
No, I wasn't stipulating like, that it's a fad. I was just saying the new thing would be called attention. But just want to caveat that. Again, fire in the comments. But
I think it was just going back a little bit. I think it was like interesting that you touched on showing the mistakes and things like that, because one of the main things that we wanted to always make sure when we were starting this podcast was make sure that obviously people have a certain, we show off the models that we show off and they're all like very high quality and we pride ourselves on that. And that is for a while, all anyone had seen from this company. We would just post out the finished models that looked great. I'm a bit biased, but they look great.
They do.
And that's all that people saw. So I think one of the biggest surprises people have when they start listening to this podcast is how open we are about our personal hobby mistakes and how things really make us feel and what we did to avoid this sort of thing. I do think that it's sort of echoing what you said, where you've seen a lot of people in your comments liking that element of it. We definitely get that as well.
Yeah,
it's clearly something that people are looking for.
I think people want honesty.
There's
been many years where it's always been like this untouchable thing that you can't, like, oh, I'd love to be able to do that, but I can't do that. And no one would tell you how to get to that. It was always like you'd ask questions and be like, oh no, it's even workshop was terrible for that. Like, would never discuss the magic. When heavy metal went to events, they couldn't talk about how they painted. When sculptors went to events, they couldn't talk about how they sculpted. I was like, why? It's like, because it like ruins the magic. It's like, it's not magic though, is it? It's just a skill.
I love no the magic. Idea of like, oh, if only Darren Latham had spoken to me and told me, then I'd be able to do it. Like, that's all, that's the only missing piece.
Big news, tickets are now on sale for the Siege Studios painting classes for 2024. For over 8 years, we've been running in-depth, hands-on classes across the UK, which has allowed us to create the perfect learning environment for improving your painting skills. With a variety of topics available, all our courses are taught by senior artists and feature practical demonstrations in a relaxed environment that welcomes interaction from you, discussions on theory, and an open Q&A session so you can ask that burning question you've had on your mind. You can even bring your models for feedback. To book now and reserve your place before tickets sell out, head over to siegestudios.co.uk/shop. I'll see you on a class soon.
What a lot of those like YouTube trends kind of skip over as well is like there's, as someone watching those videos on the other side of it, for a lot of things, there is no shortcut for practice.
Yeah.
That's something that's often overlooked. Like people are, especially when people are so time limited and there's this weird obsession with time in this hobby as a whole, which I guess is a broader conversation, but yeah, a lot of people are trying to sort of shortcut everything.
Yeah.
And like in this, James calls it like the Amazon.
Amazon of miniature painting.
Yeah.
Like there isn't dope, unfortunately, sorry to break the flow, but there is no instant gratification when it comes to miniature painting. Like we are, I'm going to say this in the most biased way, but Siege is the most closest thing to Amazon, except you don't get it next day. You know, like it takes a lot longer than that. You know, so
if you buy one of the pre-painted ones on the store, you might get it close to next day.
There is not next day. Yeah, that was a great plug, Joe.
I've been doing it 40 episodes in. I know what I'm doing.
40 episodes.
This is 41. I think that's one of the things. Like time is something that, like, you're quite right. That is potentially a whole other topic to talk about, another episode potentially, or a bit more in this one. But I think there is that thing where it's like you only see the best online. You don't realize how many hours have gone into it. You see that post go up by that person you follow. You instantly like it, whatever, blah blah. You're captivated by it, whatever. But none of the story behind that, none of the trials and tribulations, none of those things that have gone into it.
But you wouldn't like it. It's so strange as well because you wouldn't go on Instagram, see someone who's like absolutely shredded, like in incredible shape, bodybuilder, and then go to the gym twice when you're overweight and be like, why don't I look like him?
That's
exactly what I did. I started the gym and I was like, it's broken, it's not working. I don't know, I don't understand.
That's not for me, right?
Yeah, I was like,
I don't know what's going on. The game of like, well, if I just had the dumbbells he used, then I would look like that.
If he spoke to me at an event.
That's almost like, what paintbrush do you use? I'm going to go and buy 50, So yeah, like I think a lot more realness and like actually revealing the graft, which is, if you want to call it anything, the graft that goes behind, whether it's painting high end, whether it's producing a consistent army, whether it's getting an army done for a tournament in a short time frame. Like I think that's one of the things that needs to be vocalized, needs to be seen more in our industry, being frank. Like there's too much where you get a 5 minute video and you see at the beginning amazing, and you go through segmented sections that are curated to show some sort of flow without showing any of the nuances that go there. And I think it's quite human to just say, well, look, I put this color on and it didn't layer the way that I thought it was going to layer, so I had to take that off. Like no one's going to go, oh, you're crap. No one's going to say that, maybe if they're sitting at a computer with a keyboard and not in person. But for me, I think that like it just adds a sense of normality to it, which I think a lot of stuff out there doesn't have,
Well, speaking of time, something I just wanted to dive in a bit more with something you said earlier about how you really enjoy the army painting stuff for your personal hobby. So we've spoken a lot on the show about like getting the most enjoyment and just doubling down on the things you actually like doing.
Yeah.
So what is it about, or I guess we can get more specific, what is the things that you actually like really enjoy painting?
So I think it's the spectacle. That's the thing I always go for. Like when I've done like the odd character in the past, it's quite cool. I painted a character up and, that then goes on the shelf, but then what do I do with that? I've got a character. Whereas having an army, it seems to have a function. It's got an overall look to it. It's like the spectacle of it. And when certainly I was really into army painting, there was always that kind of, you're painting to a level that makes, it's not like that squad's really good or that squad's really good. It's that army looks really good. And you're painting to that, if that makes sense. You're not like trying to make each of them like amazing. You're trying to make the army look amazing. And a lot of that is through like the basing, the color choice, flags. Yeah. Really love flags. Flags on the units just looks amazing. And that was always the thing that used to... So I suppose as well, my big thing with like painting armies would be I'd have like a certain size I'd aim for, like, I don't know, like 1500 points or like a couple of regiments, a couple of characters, a vehicle or something. And then I'd play games with it. And that then inspires me to do the next couple of squads and then the next couple of squads. And that was like the driving force would be like, I'd have an idea of an army. I'd go and do it. And then I'd play some games and get really excited about it and do some more stuff, not to like win the meta or anything like that. I was just like, oh, you know, I need more tanks, because that was fun. I really liked what the tank did. And one of the things I've never really thought about it until now, but I've never copied a color scheme from the box. I've always put my own stamp on it. And I even though I did the dwarf video recently, I was looking at all the dwarfs and I was like, none of those dwarfs look like the stuff from the box packaging. I've never copied the box packaging. Mm. Why is that? And I still don't know the answer, but what I do know, and we talked about it earlier, is like you look at the stuff on the front of the boxes, you think they're really good. I'll never be able to get to that level. I think by never copying the box cover, I never get that feeling, because it would never look like the box content anyway, because it's a completely different color scheme.
It's like, yeah, you're not trying to imitate the box color scheme, so you're more okay with what you end up with.
So the psychology,
it's like, this is just my thing that I'm doing. It's a different thing.
Yeah, there is no barbecue, basically.
Yeah. It's my own take on it, and I've just done my own thing. I think there's been once or twice when I've done stuff for work, but then that has been because we created that color scheme anyway. So, like, you know, if we're like doing like the Empire, we're doing stuff for the box packaging for the Empire, but like, let's just paint them instead of red and white. Let's paint them blue and red. Let's do Altdorf instead of Talibheim. Sick and tired of seeing Talibheim. Let's do Altdorf. Like, why are we doing Altdorf? Because that's who Carl Franz works with. He's like the main character.
I'm so glad you said that about like creating a bit of a force and then playing some games with it and then making some additions or changes or things like that based off that. So I used to game quite a lot. I don't anymore. What with work and obviously just with a bit of painting and stuff that I do, I don't really get to do like a lot of gaming, and I've kind of culled that in my hobby because I personally, for me, and this is a whole other topic, like, I like something tangible for the time I've invested personally. That's just the way I look at it. But what I used to do when I was gaming is me to my friends, I used to go to like Warhammer World, used to go to like a couple of gaming clubs and stuff like that. And we used to basically have an army or whatever, and something would happen in a game, for example, like your sergeant would charge an enemy unit and like all these men would get cut down and he'd get wounded or something like that, blah, blah. And you'd make some story up that would then lead to create another character within your army that represents him further on in the path or something like that. So having that kind of like that story aspect of your army, adding things in because this happened in this, thing like that. I think that when you overlay that aspect of it from the gaming side and like create some really cool models or things or add a certain skull to the base of this character because he killed an orc war boss in combat or something like that. I think stuff like that adds so much to an overall force composition as in what it looks like as an army. And irrelevant of where it's painted to, whether everything is every metal or everything's just basically done so you can get it gaming. You mentioned basing, which is something that I'm trying to lead on to, which is obviously that adds a whole swathe of interest and detail to miniatures as well. And really, I always say this, and this is kind of getting close to the fiery topic, but like, we're getting lower on the model, don't worry. But the base for me, people always say like faces and bases, and exactly you mentioned faces earlier. Yeah, instinctively, it's the first thing a human eye recognizes because of from birth, your parents, etc., blah, blah. But like, the base and theme, and that is essentially the frame and the environment and the story that model is within. So adding a decent one of those onto the base, irrelevant rim color for the minute, is really, really part of making a full army look great when it's all together, I find. Like, I think that's a huge part of it. So one of your, what is one of your favorite armies? Is it your Venturian Nobles?
Oh God, yeah, I think so. I think that was more down to, Imperial Guard to me for 140,000, that it started moving into the realms of like modern day warfare. Mm-hmm. And as cool as they look, I always remember them being quite outlandish with their color schemes and their outfits and stuff, to the point that it was almost like Napoleonics in space. I know, obviously, Earth is in space before someone says that in the comments. I know, but you get what I mean. So you'd have, like, at least from the old art, you'd have like ranks and ranks and ranks of like guardsmen that might have ostentatious outfits. Some might be more practical, but they've got like the two banners. So if you take the old classic Imperial Guard box set, it's like the Necromundan spiders. They're all marching in line. And they've got like a couple of officers in front. They've got all these banners and it looks amazing. Granted, their outfits aren't like Napoleonic, but it's the style of fighting that they do. And when I was, it was a battle force challenge. We were all given a battle force each. And I was like, I'm an astromilitarum guard. I want to do something different. I'd already been doing an Empire army. And I was like, let's just swap the heads and then add some really outlandish, because I'm just going to make a Napoleonic army, but, you know, for Warhammer 40,000. And it was weird because I was really enjoying it. And I really liked the idea of doing just, again, this is like quick hacks for painting armor. It's like paint it black and gloss it. You get nice lacquer. But on its own, it looks a bit naff unless you do a little bit of gold trim around it. That seems to help tie it and gives it that kind of Baroque armor kind of feel. So I gave him that, gave him like magenta robes. I was like doing a color scheme when the new colors came out, because we at the time we had a glazed blood letter over certain magentas, looked really nice. I was doing that.
Great paint, that.
It was a great paint. Then they got rid of it. Bad idea. But I found another way of painting them, which is fine. And then before I knew it, it was like, we want to put that in the army book, want to get some art for it. And I'm like, why? What? This is weird. But I did notice that they put it right near like the buffet zone of like the Tyranids. So I assume at some point it'll get eaten. So in case he leaves, let's stick it over there.
Oh, I slipped in the high five.
The Ventrillians are dead. I've got an idea. I'm not going to go too much in it because I've got to try and work out how to do it. But I want to try and get a gateway from 40K to Napoleonics for my audience. And the way to do that is to use Napoleonics, because I've been putting like Marines next to the Perry miniatures, and they kind of size quite well from a Space Marine versus a human size. And I'm like, can I just get loads of like Perry miniatures, paint them as 40K troops, give them banners, but play black powder games using Napoleonics, paint them as 40K regiments, but still play Napoleonics, but making it 40K.
That's the best hybrid ever, honestly.
So I've got a whole idea of like how I want to do the video. I want to pitch it, maybe do some battle reports and stuff like that. But it's also to show that it's model agnostic. You can literally go, I want my Imperial Guard to be different than the Canians. Mm-hmm. And obviously size-wise, because of scale creep, Perry miniatures or Victrix or like Warlord games will be different in scale to Canians. But if you just kept it within that scale, and yeah, you can play in official tournaments, but if you're like me and don't care about that, then it's up to you.
Favorite
armor. Fun little idea for a game almost that I've just come up with. So
okay, he looks very proud of himself. It's gonna be good.
It's not Purge, is it?
No. Right. So we do these little occasional game show segments. This isn't quite a full beans game show, but I thought it'd be quite fun. So I've proposed the idea of, in the spirit of enjoyment, I want to know what would be your ideal hobby day. So say you've got like a free weekend, like, you know, no kids, no responsibilities, nothing.
Amazing. That is so rare, but yeah.
So I want to know what it is you're painting, at what stage in the process are you at? So like the bit that you find the most fun. So they might already all be base coated, they might be shaded, etc. And what's on in the background? Have you got like an audio book on, like a movie or something?
This is good. So I'm going to go out there. I'm not just going to be painting. I'm going to be starting from scratch. I'm going to be building an entire force. Maybe let's say a new Warcry board with two new Warcry warbands. The day's going to start off with all those in plastic sprues. They're going to be cut up. They're going to be converted. And then we're talking a weekend here. I've got 2 days, right?
Full weekend.
I'm sure we can stretch the bank holiday.
Three days.
So there's one coming up. I'm loving this. So in this 3 days, I'm watching all the Hobbit movies and all the Lord of the Rings movies back to back. Because I always find like, because certain films or certain like trilogies or whatever, you can just have in the background and not look at. Your mind's eye's filling you in.
Especially if you've seen them and you know
so much.
Yeah. 5 million times.
Yeah. Not to derail you too much, but how do you go about that with your setup? Do you have it on like a iPad screen, or do you have like a big TV and you bring your desk?
By my desk, I've got my PC with its monitor and stuff. So I'll be like doing a lot of the building there. Then I've got like a little spare desk work and then start doing the scenery and stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of scenery I want to get open and crack and start converting and doing like some new Warcry warbands and boards. So that would be my ideal weekend. And thank you, Mrs. Peach, for taking the kid out for 3 days. And they'll all be painted by the end of the weekend as well. So
I was expecting when pitching that we'd be like finishing something off maybe later in the process. We'd be kicking off.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, mine would be literally planning a project, not actually having to do it. The thought of having to fit a full project into 3 days seems like a nightmare to me.
No, that's what I'm saying. So it's your ideal like dream scenario, right? So for me, for example, if I was doing this, I would my ideal hobby day is I've already done all the prep. So like this is like the best bit.
Yeah.
So
okay,
my Marines,
yeah.
They're already base coated. I've already done like the first stage of highlights. I'm into the details. I'm going in.
All seven of them, yeah?
Yeah, all seven Marines of my army. Yeah.
I can
biggest army to date.
I can lead you into your next debate with my official answer. Oh,
come on, go for it.
So my official answer would be I've painted everything. It's all fine. Okay. And I'm just now having to do the base rim.
Oh, cool.
So I'm going to crack out Vallejo 950 black, the colour that base rim should be black, and I'm going to do all the base rims.
Right, come
on.
Roll your sleeves up. Come on. Queensby rolls. Come on then. Let's get this one done. So this all started. You were very, very kind to invite me down when you were painting phase, and obviously I came on. We spoke about base rims.
Yeah.
And we had a really good conversation about it, and you tabled brown base rims, and I said I prefer black because I think it looks like a picture frame, whatever, blah blah blah. Plus also if you touch it and the paint rubs off, you just see black base rim.
Yeah.
I nearly had you at that point because you were like I could, and you were like, but I prefer brown. I was like, damn. But we then kind of like had a group conversation on one of the episodes, and then it just kind of went a bit nuts. Like
cake was involved.
Don't bring up the cake.
It was not a great analogy. I'm sorry. All right, I don't know what to tell you. Worst, I thought it made sense in my head.
Worst analogy ever. Literally, yeah. No. So I thought it would be great on this episode to reignite the fires of fury in talking about the proverbial black or brown base.
Yeah, I like it.
Well, so, I've got support, I think, this time.
Yes, it's 2v2 this time.
Yeah. Do you know what, though? I know I've just sort of brought this up and really ramped it up, but we said we were going to do it anyway. But I've only just got, it's been enough time since we spoke about it that I feel like I can paint other base rims. Yeah. For a while, I felt like I should only paint black base rims because I've said this and I've stood by it. And similar to the sub-assembly thing, people, especially George, pulling me up on it every time. So now it's been long enough. I'm like, okay, yeah, I can get away with not painting black base rims if I want to now. People aren't necessarily remembering about it. We've put that to bed. And now we're going to light that fire again.
Yeah.
And I'm now going to have to paint black base rims for the rest of my life.
Well, I've painted a variety of base rims in my time. I've done black a few times, and I found that they are really good for board games. Mm-hmm. So when I've done like Underworlds or Silver Tower or whatever, it kind of feels like it's part of the board game. It's mm-hmm. weird. And before that, I used to do green, goblin green rims for the old sort of like flock at the top and stuff like that. And the brown rim was the winner for me for a multitude of reasons. Doesn't mean it's right.
Oh no, there's no right or wrong. It's just
what works for me.
Oh, now there's no right or wrong. We get Peachy on the show and all of a sudden there's no right or wrong.
It is right. And there's a couple of reasons. One, we used to, when I was in the studio, everything was rimmed the same. And there was two reasons for that. One, it looked visually pleasing on the photography because black was just too harsh. It was kind of a jump, and it was the same for like on boards as well. And as an army painter and gamer, I've done like grays and like dark greens, and I've done black, and it's kind of like really jarring to my eyes when I've got the army on the table. Whereas the brown that we settled on originally, it was Graveyard Earth, and it went Steel Legion drab, was a little bit more subtle, and it could work with any sort of terrain type. So if like I'm playing with my army that's on a desert board, and they've got like brown sort of soil with grass, with like the Steel Legion drab rim, it looks fine. Then if I move on to a city, it looks fine. It's less jarring. So from that kind of point of view, that's why I've always done it brown. But there's also another reason why we always did it brown in the studio, and that's because you can change it to any color in Photoshop. So if you put like my Stormcast Eternals, which have got like a gray sort of surface of soil and they've got a brown rim, you put that on a snowboard, you can easily, with your curves and like your luminetrics, change it to white.
Oh, right.
You can't do that with black, or it's a lot harder. You have to mask everything off. And then it's a lot harder for the graphic designers. So the graphic designer is always like, can you make it brown, please? Because it's really easy to
fix. So it's the graphic designer's fault this whole time?
It was a mutual.
Yeah. You were like, no problem there. That's what I prefer anyway.
But they could literally turn it to black, grey.
Yeah, yeah.
Martian, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, it does make sense.
I'm
still painting black.
Yeah. But I mean, like, even now, I've got like some that are painted black because they use them for board games. So, totally. Shatterpoint.
It does fit what you're saying, though, because I particularly into Underworlds at the minute. Mm. Maybe that's one of the reasons that I've gravitated towards it, is that my black base rims fit in a bit better.
Don't go to the darkness. Don't do it. Don't do it.
See, my take for it, if we're dialing back to our episode from a while ago.
Cake. Sorry, cake. Burned by peachy.
So going back to my cake analogy, the reason what I said was, everyone slated me as like team brown base room. That wasn't it. What I said was it should be painted to match whatever the basing scheme is, which oftentimes is like generic, like dirt, grass, tufts, sort of thing, which is why the Steel Legion drab makes sense, works for most things. But I did also say, if it's like a black scheme or dark or grey, go for that. Makes sense.
Yeah. It just, I suppose it depends on people's own personal boards and their setups. Like if they've only got like a grey city fight, then it makes sense to do everything grey, right? But then if you're going around to your mates and they're on a jungle, it just looks a bit weird.
If you're enjoying this episode of Paint Perspective, I just wanted to ask that you do us a huge favour by leaving a rating and review on whatever platform you're using, and also choosing to follow and subscribe. It'd really help us out, and it helps us deliver these episodes to you for free every week. Now back to the show.
So I'm going to throw something in here because this is something that we've not discussed on here before. And I think that it segues nicely and fits on. I've never understood having the models on transparent discs.
Oh, yeah.
So start on that. So I get the, I kind of understand that you can take it anywhere and it matches the board, etc. Yeah. But it just looks odd to me. I don't know about that. There's something about putting a basing material or something on the base and putting tufts on it and painting it and adding like skulls on and all that kind of stuff that for me is like part of the finishing process.
Yeah.
So to just spend hours painting the model as nice as you want to paint it for the level you want to paint it for, whatever the army's going to look like, and then you put it on, just glue it to a transparent disc.
What about?
Oh God.
What about when they're like certain GW models, for example, drones?
And yeah, towel drones
come with transparent discs. Are you? Would you still base them?
Yeah.
The towel drones frustrate me because they're not the right. They haven't got that thick. Like, there's no. You can't base rim.
Yeah.
One of those.
So
it's like a weird, like you could leave it clear, but you could also not leave it clear. But if you don't leave it clear, it's not quite a base.
Yeah. So some just them, about a
do you know what you need? You need a 5mm drill bit and a dwarf, and you drill through the middle of a base and put the flight stand in a normal base, 25mm, 28.5 potentially. But yeah, you put it in one of those, and then you can have.
Yeah, actually, I've seen people do that before, where they put the drones.
Right, I'm gonna. They sometimes come with them.
It's triggered. Here we go.
Sometimes a tower drone comes with a proper base.
Sometimes, yeah, it does. Yeah. But I think I prefer drones and things like that, or like any like little friends. Let's put it that way. I prefer them on
actual bases
rather than being on a thing. But yeah, I remember going to a tournament once, and I was playing somebody, and like they just got out of their army, and the army was stunning, like beautiful army. But I was like, they're all on like just. Bits of perspex. I was like, I thought the kind of, I get it totally because you put it on the table and then the table you're on, it blends in and stuff, but it just looks
would
a bit,
that
a bit
make
odd.
More sense for board games potentially, the transparent thing,
what, the discs?
Yeah,
well, see, even Space Hulk, even like the set, is it the second edition space? No, it's not second, it's the third edition, isn't it? It's the
whichever
one with the the third edition, they had like the Terminators had like squares of plastic. They didn't have a proper base, did they?
They almost had like bases built into the model.
But
so I wonder, just because you said about black base rims working really well with the board games, I wonder if like maybe there's a place for a transparent perspex in that regard. I guess because you can like see the.
I think you're either going to like the look of it or not, though. With that,
I've seen people where they get a printout of the actual, like let's say Silver Tower. They print out like some of the board sections and then put that on the base, so it looks like it ties in, which is quite nice. Talking about the plastic base rims, I remember doing an Eldar army, and we put it in the cabinet and we based the actual flying stands because it looked cooler because it then tied in with all the infantry and stuff. It just visually looked better, even though they're like different shapes. And I remember one of the exec walked through and he was just like, aren't they clear? It's supposed to be clear bases. I was like, yeah. He's like, why have you based them? Because it looks better. Why are we making them then if that's the case? And I was like, I have no answer to
good
that.
Good point, yeah.
And he was like, well, that's stupid because they cost a lot of money to make. And I was like, and if you're just going to base them, what's the point? And I was like, well, some people don't want to. And he was like, yeah, but that needs more looking into. So I guess if you see a lot of basing stuff nowadays, like the Astartes stuff, they tend to have like the curvy or whatever the stem, but it's on a normal base.
Yeah,
on a normal
base, yeah.
So I wonder if they've just like looked at that and gone, see, it's a waste of cash.
The way I always look at it is like, I mean, obviously that I didn't know that point perspective of it, but I was literally just like, well, the drone is, if you've got an army on a terrain or like on a world, like ice world or like whatever, blah, blah. Like if you've got an army on that environment, and I understand totally that drone or the Falcon or the whatever it is that's on the flying stand is flying nothing connecting it to the ground. I get that totally. But I find it looks stranger, a random perspex complete object when everything else is like an environment. It's like they somewhere else. Like, you know, so I think that's why what I used to do is use the transparent flight stand, put it on a normal base, base that so that that model is still unified with the rest of the army.
Yeah.
But
similar that's to the like, way I'd do it. Yeah.
Similar to like how some of the tanks, I suppose it's only ever if they're flying like a Repulsor or something, but they have bases now, don't they?
I started basing, I didn't at first because I thought it was stupid, but then I think it was like a Space Wolf army. I ended up basing the attack bike because actually in comparison to the bikes, it looked stupid because the bikes are on like ovals at the time, or on whatever the weird cavalry base it was now. It's an
the American
oval.
Football base.
But it's like it needs to go on a round base because then it's the same height as the rest of it because it was always weird because you had like the bikes that were like at a certain height, then the attack bike which was really low because it didn't get a base, and it just used to, I don't know, trigger me in my own like sort of like, that doesn't look right. And then ever since then I did a Jean Silicult army, all my bikes and my quad bike were on bases, so I'm sticking all my trucks on bases.
I remember when I first started getting back into it and noticing that obviously a lot of the tanks at the time before Primaris, so a lot of the tanks weren't on bases. And I always thought, I don't know how much of a divisive topic this is if people have like particularly strong feelings on it, but I was like, shouldn't they just have bases still? I get they're a big model, but it'd be cool to have like a Rhino on a base. I don't know why that's not.
You know what's really weird? Like the older editions of 40K, it would have made more sense then for them to have them on bases because then you can easily work out real
fire arcs.
Fire arcs and stuff like
that. Is that one of those things though where it's like if you do it for that, you've got to do it for everything. And then all of a sudden you've got like.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, do it for
1 meter long bases for a wall on
Titan. You pretty much need a pizza board for a Land Raider. So like it's a massive kit, isn't it? And then like obviously you need the surround to do the basing actually around it. But that's the bit where I'm a little bit divisive on it. Cause like, I agree that like drones and all those things personally should have like the basing on the flight stands or like a base that's a normal base or whatever. But I remember seeing a Rhino put on like one of those night bases before.
Yeah.
And it looked weird. It just looked really odd. I understand totally like, because everything else is based and it kind of like, it's a bit of an oxymoron with what I was saying about the drone or the Falcon or whatever, blah, blah. But I just think it looks weird. I don't know. Like,
it does open you up to kind of making the basing more of a part of the model, though,
doesn't
it? If the base is substantial enough, I'm not talking about with like the Repulse or whatever, because it's a tiny little thing, but if the base was like more substantial, you could potentially have like crew on foot or like, you know, maybe like a track has like come off or something, like a mini diorama. I think like the Field Ordnance battery, new Cadian things, like almost doing that, but like with the tank or something.
I just remember the very first time I saw it, I think it was in a White Dwarf. I opened it and there was just like this Rhino on like a dinner plate. And I was like, why is it on a base? But do you know what it is? I think it's through seeing tanks without bases for like 20 years, like in White Dwarf or wherever you go, just with no bases. And all of a sudden just seeing one of the bases. Yeah, like
probably a lot of it. It's just getting over it.
I had the same reaction when I saw it the first time and then I'm okay with it now, which is weird.
So what advice would you give to somebody if they're going to paint their first army? So maybe they're painting like Underworlds sort of warbands or Warcry warbands or Necromunda gang or something like that. Like what for you makes sort of like the painting process for an army? What things would you recommend somebody who's literally just like, oh, I've painted like five models. I want to paint 50 or like 60.
Can I just extrapolate on that before you answer it as well? Maybe potentially even what is it about big army projects for you that doesn't scare you? Because I know a lot of people would think, like smaller is better. Myself personally, I always want to be painting like single figures, but you said you enjoy the mass of it all. So what is it about having so many models that doesn't scare you, I suppose? Because that's quite intimidating for a lot of people.
Yes, I mean, there is a discipline required to work your way through a unit of 20 a night or something like that. But I think the biggest thing I would always say is, and There is a bit of a danger here as well, is to do a test model, always do a test model. It's something I get a lot of feedback on when I'm doing like my one-to-ones or chatting to people about the hobby, is the first question I always say is, did you do a test? And they're like, no. And that's usually why your army ends up being a bit of a car crash, because you start painting everything at the same point. So there's been a few people that have been, like, say they've been doing Grey Knights and they painted their 30 figures. They sprayed it silver, then they put the wash on it, and then they did the gold, and now it's not working. I'm like, did you do one to completion first? And they're like, no. That's probably why you're having to do all this extra work now, because once you start making those mistakes, you have to then correct all those mistakes on 30 figures. So I always think, do a test model. The problem with doing the test model is you always want to put more effort into it. So then it gives you a bit of a sort of a jarring end result. But the thing with the test model, it does two things for me, is I know where all the colors are going. I know the process, but then what I can do is extrapolate things for sort of speed and efficiency. So I'll look at the test model and I'll go, you know what? Actually, I sprayed this originally gray. It's actually going to be a lot easier if I spray it silver. Mm. And that's going to cut out like hours of work if I spray it silver, because all I'm doing is picking out the gold here and then picking out some red here, picking out some black here. Why did I start off with gray? That's a really weird choice. So that's the great thing about doing a test model. You can look at that and make those choices. But then from like doing big armies, don't go mad. Mm. You know, you can cut corners. You don't have to, like, on a test model, you want to highlight the belts. You want to avoid highlighting the belts. I know it's one figure, and you're looking at the figure going, but it needs highlighting. But then when you put it at arm's length, and then you've got another 10 guys around you, you're like, oh, that looks cool. Doesn't matter, I didn't highlight the belts. So I do think the test model is key, but it can cause issues. And nowadays, because I've got the confidence, I tend to test model the unit champion, because I always put a bit more effort into the test model. I know it sounds like really bad, like, oh, I don't make mistakes, but I know roughly in my mind's eye, because I've got the experience of it, I can visualize what it looks like. So chances are my mistakes will be minimal and I can easily correct them, but my sergeant will look mega.
Yeah.
and then the rest of the guys around it will be, you know, I'll cut the corners on those where needs be, because usually the sergeant's the last guy left alive.
I was hoping that you were going to finish with that, because like, you put so much effort into that one more, everyone dies around him. He's like, let's cut more highlights on his cloak than me. I'm next. It's like the red shirt in Star Trek.
Yes, yeah. It's like that. It's a bit of a meme, but it's like, oh, he had a better gaming chair than me.
So we've spoke a little bit, and you've kind of touched on it briefly in terms of whether you're tackling like a single model or armies or anything like that, is restricting yourself to different levels, if you like. And obviously we have to do it through the commissions, because we offer different services. Bronze, silver, gold. And I think it's funny, a lot of the perception that people might have is that maybe someone would struggle to move up the levels. But a lot of the issues that we have is people restricting themselves to the lower levels. So people like George, who can paint the gold tier, just that's their standard.
Yeah.
If I give George a bronze model to paint, he struggles, because it's like,
yeah,
where do I cut the corners and things like that?
You add a black basement onto that's game over.
I have started, like, whenever I've allocated George's thing, if it's got a black basement, I'll put in brackets like obviously or something like that. Actually a lot of clients have side referenced it on.
We've had this with the clients now. I get a spec from the clients written the spec, and they'll be like jokes like on the basement.
Anyway, that's not what I was getting. I didn't want to go back on the basement.
Sorry,
you're being trolled by the clients. Yeah.
I encourage it personally. But so what I'm getting at is, you obviously then have to do that yourself, where it's like, if you're painting a single model, you can go to whatever this higher level that you've set yourself, or what you've just alluded to, when you're painting an army, you can strip things back. Do you have certain kind of set levels, even if you haven't really written it like that or thought of it like that? Do you know, okay, I'm doing an army, so here's what I'm going to cut, or here's what I'm going to get to? Do you have that?
I do, yeah. It depends on like the force. So if I'm like doing the Pennonics, for instance, there's a lot of figures that needed for that, for the tabletop. So I tend to base coat wash most of it. It's rare that they get highlights, except the face. Only highlight the face. Mm. And the reason for that is, once they're based and the flags are up there, the first thing you notice with the Pennonics is not the face, it's the flags. It's the spectacle of like 24 to like 36 figures in line. bright looking colors, because when I wash them as well, I don't like wash them straight from the palm, really thin it down, so you get more of the color punching out and it's just like settled in the recesses a bit. And the spectacle of that is like they're all in line, they've got like red coats, they've got big hats, and there's like two big flags. That so my standard for that is like pretty much base coat, shade, don't do anything more with that. Like the muskets, it's brown with some silver. I've started using chrome pens now as well on like the bayonets, because it catches the light really nice.
Yeah, we had some chat about pens on the
we've had a little while ago.
There's that that War Colors company that's green replicator like pen.
Yeah, it's like a highlight rooms. It's like a highlighter pen, so you can get the base room and just go around.
They only do green.
I heard about this, one of the commenters pointed it out to us, and I was like, brilliant, I'm getting one of those. They only do Goblin Green.
Yeah, which I actually kind of love. That
No, we'll do more. We'll make them do more.
Don't say that. There'll be an email. There'll be an email coming in.
You guys are like, where's black? Why is it no black?
Yeah.
But yeah, like with like big forces, like big battles, big games, that I definitely restrict the level. I've got, I've not done it yet, but I intend to do a diorama for Salute, which is going to be a British square. But I will be putting a bit more effort into that. I've still not decided how much effort, because I'm going to probably turn it into a video as well. It's more just to make a diorama and put it into Salute. I don't expect to win anything. It'll be quite fun just to see how far it gets.
That's a great idea, Square.
It's more the spectacle. I'm like testing myself as well. Like, it's not about the painting. It's about the narrative as well. Because for me, like when I've done dioramas in the past, the painting is important. But I think sometimes it's the storytelling that's going off in the diorama. And I think over the years, the dioramas, certainly from when I was a kid, have got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it's become a jewel. And I want to go back to like the full sort of like, I've got 50, 60 figures on this diorama. I think I can cut a couple of corners on the paint jobs, because it's the spectacle that you're going for.
The emotion, the movement.
So that's just a test for that. But then if I roll back to like Warhammer, then I will probably base coat, shade, do a highlight. If it's like a character, I'll probably put a couple more highlights into it. And then there is the other level, which is, you know, as I've done before, like higher end stuff, but that's usually if I'm just like in the mood for it.
You do need to be in a specific frame of mind to do that, because it is taxing, like you know. Not to say that, like, I think painting high level, similar to what I was saying at the very earlier in the episode, like, it just as much thought and process goes into painting so high end as doing an army that's consistent but not as much of a level. It's still taxing, but I've been there batching through 40 models in one go, or 50 models in one go, or whatever, blah blah, and you do get to like number 48 out of 50. You're like, I've got two more of you to do. Just like, come on. So I know I do think it's just as taxing, but I think there is, like we always say, there's that happy medium between size and volume and level, etc. But the ability to fluctuate, I think, is really important as a painter. I think it's something that helps you to, I always call it like feed different fires. You know, like you've got that passion to do something really that you want to be the pride of your collection, or you've got that thing that you, that spectacle, that diorama, that army, that emotion, that story that you want to tell, that maybe doesn't need that as much, you know? So
Where does like painting for content come into all of this? Because something I've noticed is, for obvious reasons, it's very, very difficult to paint really high-end stuff and consistently be putting out videos about it just because of that time sink. So do you find that having to paint projects to be on video is different to how you'd paint personally?
Yeah, so I mean, I put time aside each day to do my filming and stuff, and if I have the energy or the enthusiasm, I'll do stuff for myself in the evenings. And I've got to the point now, I'm like, this could just be content. I could just film this whilst I'm painting. The only thing I find really hard with like the filming side of stuff is you have to paint a little bit different than what you do when you're sat comfortably in your space. Because I have my model quite close up, I'm like painting. I can't do that with camera, because you'd just be getting my ears and cheeks in the way all the time. And I'll constantly be like, oh, that's blurry. Oh, it's better. No, I missed it. Oh, it's dry. I've got to do that again. So, you know, you're constantly having to like work to the camera, which is a slightly different discipline than doing it for yourself. But I do try and make time for, at the moment, it's been like a lot of Star Wars content, Shatterpoint. I don't know why. I played a few games of Shatterpoint. I just really like
the models are great.
The models are really nice. I'm just going to flip back to something about the standard as well. One of the things I tend to do is I like to camouflage my models with effects that are actually quite easy to do but look like I put more effort in. So a lot of it's marking. So if I do like some markings on like a Stormcast, like heraldry on the shield, or if I like do like clone troopers with the Ahsoka markings, the markings themselves, because I found like ways of which will be a video at some point, like making the her actual markings on the helmet. I found a quick way of doing that. There's not, I say a quick way, and a more approachable way of doing it. But it makes the model look like I put more effort into it than I actually have. And it's probably what I'd probably say is a tabletop standard, but because I put a marking on it, did that in the base coat stage, I've washed it. It looks like I've spent a lot longer on it, which has then camouflaged the model to then no longer be tabletop, but look like it's something else. So that's...
So do you find that you like, with the content, are you... It's interesting when you speak to me about this, because I kind of go one or two ways. Some people, like with the commissions on our team, for example, some people be like, I'm painting commissions all day. When I do my own stuff, I just want to get it done.
Yeah. Or
there'll be other people who are like, oh, I have to paint it within this box because it's a commission.
Yeah.
When I do my own stuff, I want to go mad and I want to paint it to like the highest level possible. So for you, where does that line lie? So if you was not painting for video, would you find that it would be maybe less restricted or more restricted?
I think it depends on what I'm painting, weirdly. If I'm doing like Napoleonics, like I said, I'll just be like bashing it out because I want to get them on the table and get to the part where I'm putting flags on because it looks cool. But if I'm doing like Warcry or Kill Team, I'll put a bit more effort into like the highlights, maybe do like the old little jaggedy things to make like the cloth look torn, do more scratches on the armor and stuff. Again, it's that camouflaging thing, but I tend to just go with the flow and just go, oh, I'm going to do that and oh, I'm going to do that. So I do put more effort sometimes, I think, into my own personal hobby. Again, because a lot of the stuff I do for camera is more like you can get to this point with these steps and it'll look like that. And some of the things I do for myself, I'm like, oh, I should show how to do that because that's quite easy to do. But I think I need to make sure I get all the fundamentals covered first before I go down that route. So later on down the line, I'll do more like cool effects with simple methods or whatever. But yeah, I guess it's the mood, what mood I'm in. If I'm in a really sort of like, I want to put a bit more effort in mood, I'll do that. If I want to just like chill out and take my time, I'll do that. So yeah. I don't have a hard and fast rule, really. Sorry.
I think it's like,
such a fence
that's a good answer.
That's like, it is a really good answer actually, because it's like something that we've kind of touched on a few times is making sure that you're having fun with whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
And that a large part of that is, what am I in the mood for now?
Yeah.
Don't force myself to do something that I'm not in the mood for, kind of thing. It does feel like the kind of fundamental, like essential tip to army painting is like, is those levels, understanding that those levels are okay and understanding what your version of those levels are.
Yeah.
Because that's, I think some people are so surprised to hear that maybe our painters, for example, don't paint to that level all the time.
They
have their own stuff where they might paint a little bit less, or same for yourself, where like they'll see something that you've painted to a really high level and then see something that you haven't. I think it, people get surprised by that, when really I think that's the key to actually managing to paint all that.
I mean, I used to see heavy metal do that all the time. There's a couple of guys that would do their own little armies and they were just like dry brushed. I'm just like, I'm so proud. Dry brushing. I'm like, do you even know what that technique is? They're like, yeah, I found it out the other day in a book. How to paint Citadel miniatures from 1990. Yeah, cool.
It's a great book, that. Red cover, that one, I think it is.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to get even more painting tips and techniques from us here at Siege, head over to our Patreon. With the Siege Studios Patreon, you'll gain access to a catalogue of over 250 PDF and video tutorials covering a variety of techniques, from our foundation tutorials to full character masterclasses and much more. We also have a tier just for you podcast listeners to help support the show. So if you want to take your paintings to the next step and make the most of your hobby time, head over to patreon.com/Siege Studios. Question of the week time. Thank you everyone for submitting your questions for question of the week. If you have a question that you would like us to answer on the show in a future episode, please leave it in the comments down below on YouTube. This week we have a question from KGP277. Who says, what are your thoughts on weathering and chipping with a sponge versus a brush?
Ooh.
Guess, yes. We have a guest, so I think we should let the guest open on that one.
Yeah.
I mix it up. I use both. So if I'm painting a space marine, I'll use sponge because it gives me nice random effects on the armor. But there's just some places you can't get to with the sponge, so I'd go in with a brush. And then I find once I've done those little bits with a brush, I just do a couple more around on the armor. But I find the sponge sort of method is kind of erratic and a little bit more, what's the word? Word amnesia. It's not regimented. It's the opposite of regimented.
No, I get that.
Yeah. So it's like, it's a bit all over the place, where sometimes the danger when you're doing with a brush, you can be a bit too sort of
especially finicky. I find that I'm worse when I'm trying to be random and sporadic with a brush.
Random, that's the word. Thanks.
When I'm trying to be random with a brush, I end up overthinking it and just I look at it and then I'm like, okay, no, that looks like I've tried it to looks, be yeah, random. Yeah. That doesn't look random.
It like looks cookie cutter basically.
Whereas the sponge, like you say, first step sponge is gonna go all over the different places you couldn't even work out how to do yourself. So it's like a great base layer for the weathering and then going with the brush after, I think.
I think a lot of people approach this in the sense of like what's speedy or more efficient, but I think something that's often overlooked is like the sense of scale.
Mm.
So for me personally, I find that a sponge is much more appropriate for a larger model because, you know, if a tank is being hit by, you know, massive shells, then it's going to make bigger marks on it. But if you're just a marine, you're getting hit with like shrapnel. It might just make a little nick or a scratch.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It also kind of depends on, are we talking like armor or are we talking like, you know, other surfaces, how thick that is, what it's made of.
Mm.
I find that both is often great as well, because even like I said, even if it is a massive model, odds are it's going to be hit with like debris and shrapnel as well as larger arms fire. So it's kind of like mixing up the different like scale for me when I'm doing the brush. Also, there is the sense of like you can be much more precise with a brush completely, but making it like suit the model. That's something as well. This is like completely unrelated, but that's one of the reasons that I really love really, really, really small tufts for basing, because it makes a marine feel like he's 9 foot tall rather than making him feel like, okay, we're supposed to be this like super soldier. But for some reason in this universe, it only seems to be very, very small tufts of 6 foot tall grass. Always coming up to his hip. It doesn't make sense.
I want to throw in two different directions into this, because there's two things that I think that I see a lot of people that use sponging on classes and whether we talk to people, et cetera, blah, blah. Every time when we do like a lot of weathering, like sort of tutorials and stuff like that, like a lot of people will go very heavy handed with a sponge, like, and the whole less is more really, really does, touching upon the scale thing, it really does contribute massively to that. I've had it before where someone's first go at doing like a weathered panel or something like that, they'll show obviously doing, because you could sit there theoretically and just do every single little dot, but then you have the thing that you were saying about where it gets cookie cutter, or it looks, you're trying to be random, and actually, believe it or not, it's very difficult when you're painting miniatures and you're, if you've had sort of like a training, or like you've learned how to paint box art style, or you've done more an artistic style, whatever, blah, blah, because you're still following inadvertently a process, it's actually really hard to do random, like really, really, really hard.
Yeah. Especially between different models, because even if you nail it on one, you'll find that that's actually your process for doing it. And then you'll do it on a different model. And you go, oh, you're hit by the exact thing. Really. The exact same thing at the exact same time.
Everyone's diving in front of everyone else. Yeah. Taking shots. A lot of people go very heavy handed with sponging to start off with, I find, like, because it's like, oh yeah, get it on the model. It's like, oh, what have I created?
It's so fun. It's so easy to overdo. It's so hard to restrict yourself.
It touches back to that thing with that episode with Dave where he was the butt effects. He's just like flicking it at the model But it's very much like being more subtle with it and gentle with it. And also touching on the second point, which is kind of twofold. It's like thinking how that object has interacted with the environment and what actually would get damaged or would get affected or what wouldn't. The common one is that you'll have transfers or freehand marking or something on the panel, and you sponge all over the model to create damage, but then you don't do the transfer, or you don't
put
do the
transfer
thing.
On.
So you're going to shoot everything and then go, oh, lovely bit of artwork. I'll just leave that. So there's that. And the other thing is obviously material as well. I think sponging can be used for all manner of different textures. It's like instinctively a lot of people approach it in the thought process of doing it for like rust and stuff like that, which is perfect, because you can do two-tone, the highlight color and the chip color or the rust color, or whatever, blah, blah. But like you were talking earlier, and something to touch upon is obviously like cloth and fabric.
Yeah.
Like you can do amazing, amazing texture on cloth, like with tiny bits of sponge. Like Daz has done that thing where he puts the sponge inside the thing that you lose all the time, which I can't remember what it's called, the brush protector.
Oh, like the brush capsule. Yeah, I lose them all the time. And I said that on a podcast thinking I'd have loads of comments of people being like, oh yeah, I lose them as well. Every comment was how do you lose that? Like,
there's a special wormhole where they go in.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I've had that. I've got one that I still can't find. It was like literally next to my tissue.
Yeah, it's just exactly.
Gone.
Yeah,
it's just gone. It's gone.
It's that thing where like you put it down on the desk, you turn your head away, you turn back, and it's gone.
Yeah.
I was airbrushing the other day on my booth, and literally, for some reason, I use a big base as like a test surface just to make sure the consistency is right on the airbrush when I've done a dilution. and I knocked it underneath the, there's a little like lip underneath the oh, thing. No. And I lifted the thing up. There was about five. Under, I was like, I found it. I found where they go. Yeah. But what I was trying to say was like that putting that sponge in like the, in the brush protector, it's really good for like being able to control it.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
And then like you can get a tiny bit of sponge, put it in the end. And then like, if you've got like a loincloth, you can do like several stages of sponging, and the depth that it gives you on like material is really good. Rather than, cause I, cross action is really good. If you can get those straight lines as really tiny as possible as you can, it obviously, but otherwise the weave would be like, like crazy, if that makes sense. But
it's kind of like a hybrid of stippling really at that point, isn't it?
Yeah. But then also like other things like sponge, the other good thing with sponging as well, just like, it's not even like, I think again, it's something that is massively overlooked, like you said, whereby like, you know, obviously Byron from AO, for example, he puts down like a sponge layer first before he does like stuff as well. So he always like stipple on or sponge on, and then we'll do the dry brushing over the top, if that makes sense. So it almost makes like a really good foundation for them building other paints and stuff on as well. I think, as I said, sponging is massively overlooked in some cases. And it can add so much to a model, even whatever level you're trying to paint to, or whatever kind of like finish you're trying to paint to as well. So,
well, you mentioned about the texture on cloth. I've done it a few times where I've used sponge, and it gives it a nice sort of like a, I wouldn't say velvet, but kind of gives that kind of texture that velvet has if you just work on those edges a bit. But it looks quite nice. A couple of glazes, and then it's really good. Down. Good for blood as well.
Yeah,
blood splatter.
Yeah.
And talking about scale, like, you know, and use a sponge, it's good for like things like Adeptus Titanicus stuff, because then your dots are a bit smaller. So kind of scale is a bit better, because if I like try and do blood splatters on Adeptus Titanicus stuff, it's like...
It's had a bath.
It's huge. But yeah.
The same thing works for like chips as well, because like I've seen Adeptus Titanicus stuff and the chips are like massive on it. It's like, what, has someone thrown like a bus? Someone thrown like a bus at the Titan or something. Like it's like massive chip. Right? But yeah.
Something that's really nice to do as well is like you put down your layer with the sponge in like your highlight color, and then going in with a brush of a slightly brighter color and using that sponge layer as a guide and just picking out a few of those little markings and just making them just a little bit brighter.
So it looks like it's a damage to the paint rather than going down to the
material.
Yeah,
it's like multiple stages.
That's awesome.
And that helps with the randomness as well, because you've kind of already got this template that the sponge has given you, and that gives you just something to follow. Like you're just painting over what's already there.
Definitely. Yeah, it's really, really good.
I've got a question to throw at you.
Sure.
Something I've always experienced when I was in the oil painting team. Do you guys highlight your transfers or your decals?
Oh, that's a difficult one. That came up in your video recently, because I watched that.
Not a question you get often, is it?
No, it isn't. Yeah. No, that's a really interesting one. I thought your point of it's something that's been painted on the model, so wouldn't have an edge to catch light.
Unless it's on the edge of a piece of armor.
Yeah, so I agree with you. But then at the same time, when I freehanded stuff, I put edges on it.
I have
a good answer for this.
Come on in.
I don't highlight them. I shade them.
Oh.
So, for example, say like an classic ultramarine shoulder pulsion transfer. Yeah. I won't edge it.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't make sense, because it's not an edge.
Yeah.
But I will, like if you're painting to a high level model, you'll see, especially Evermat will do this, like they'll glaze down the volume. So towards the bottom of the shoulder, it's slightly darker. It's in shadow because it's got the high point at the top. So I'll follow the same suit with the transfer. So say with the ultramarine, it's like the white. I'll go in with like a slightly off-white or like a darker grey, and I'll glaze that towards the bottom of the transfer to show the volume.
Nice.
Okay, this is our little closing segment that we do every single show called Hobby Hacks. This is where we share a little hack with you that you can hopefully implement into your painting.
Mm.
And this week we have one from our guest.
Oh, yeah.
What an introduction.
So you may have seen it on some of the videos I've done in the past. You may not be aware of it, but I use masking tape to make clothes and cloth. I don't use green stuff. And the reason for that is every time I've tried to use green stuff, I always get it wrong. There's so many fingerprints on it and it ends up being thicker than fabric itself. So I've started using masking tape and I cut it to the shape I wanted to do. So like if I'm doing a cloak, I'll like do like a little bit of a cloak shape, and I could just manipulate it around the model, drop a super glue, it folds however you want it to fold. Once you spray it, it goes quite hard. A few people in the comments have gone, but it's tacky on one side. Not when you spray it, it's not. It's gone. Trust me, it's gone. But then I started experimenting, doing other things like bandages. I did like a talon with like the head wrap. So I used Acadian, filed down the head a bit, and then just did a head wrap fan in, just twisting the masking tape. So I did like a big long strip of it. I found just by twisting it as I'm going around the head, gave it more volume and like kind of, bulbous as you'd expect from like a head wrap. But if you just do it straight as it is, it just looks stupid and comical.
Yeah.
But I use masking tape for so much
That's brilliant. I've never heard that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite rare that we come up with, we often joke about how bad some of these hobby hacks are.
After 41 episodes, they're getting a bit thin.
Yeah. I've never heard that.
Yeah.
That's quite incredible.
I made a really sexy looking ogre for my daughter's Ken, because I do.
I never thought I'd hear anybody ever say I made a sexy looking ogre.
Yeah, I did. So I did some man eaters for my AOS stuff, and I've got like Daughters of Cain, and I thought I'm going to do an ogre for the Daughters of Cain, but he needs thigh high boots. How do I make thigh high boots on an ogre? It's the most disturbing thing I've ever done. It was the fire belly who's like doing that, but in the end I gave him like a shield and a dagger, and he had like a weird sort of mask which kind of fit with the Sisters of Slaughter.
Yeah.
And I just used masking tape, give him thigh-high boots, and it looked mega. Disturbing, but mega.
That is amazing.
It's probably the best hobby hack we've ever had. I'm actually not even joking. That's more actually an insult to us than the competitive.
All right, speak for yourself, Slate. All right.
It just take a bit of time getting used to like folds and stuff. And I've shown a few people like in person doing it. I did some Tanith, and I made, because I had like a load of spare Cadians, and the new plastic Tanith guys came out. They looked really nice. And I tried to mimic that kind of poncho cloak, and they have like some little tabs on the side, so I just use like little bits of masking tape which I just cut out to make the tabs, and it just looked fine.
Can I ask how you had this idea in the first place?
A necessity, because I had no green stuff one day and I needed to do a cloak, and I went oh.
So I'm gonna touch on this with the fact that you said about green stuff, because I see some of the stuff that some of the CS team do with like capes and robes and stuff. I'm like, how have you got that thin, or how have you sculpted that, whatever, blah blah. And normally when I've ever tried to do capes or stuff like that, most normally capes, they end up looking like, have you ever seen clothes when they've been on the washing line in winter where they're frozen?
Yes.
It looks like the cape is like that. It's like, it's a solid piece of, looks like card, like, rather than flowing lovely material. It's like this cape that just projects diagonal at a perfect angle out of the model. So that's really interesting. I'd say like the genius behind using that is just crazy.
Maybe the masking tape will solve that for you.
Yeah, that is absolutely mega.
You get folds in it, stays in place, spray it. Use a bit of PVA if you want to harden it a bit more, but spray does it.
That's mega.
Amazing.
That's absolutely awesome. Yeah. No, that's perfect. Brilliant.
Okay. Well, thank you, Peachy, very much for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah. So do you want to tell all the listeners where they can go find your new channel?
You can go and find me on Peachy Tips. And if you don't know what that is, it's my new channel, and it looks like a teapot. That's a paint pot. That's a teapot. It's me.
And the socials are all Peachy Tips.
All Peachy Tips now, yeah.
They'll all be linked in the description as well. If you're
thank you very much.
And in the show notes if you're listening on audio. Oh.
Yeah, just to add for you didn't, I did not find Peachy in the tea aisle. It was
he
it
did.
Was, yeah, I did.
He did.
Don't shatter the illusion.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Peachy.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone for listening to this week's episode of Paint Perspective. We will see you next week.